As audio technology has advanced, so has our love affair with deep bass. Dr. Paul Jason's book, Low-End Theory, Bass, Bodies, and the Materiality of Sonic Experience, probes a much mythologized field of bass and low-frequency sound. It begins in music, but quickly moves far beyond, following vibratory phenomena across time, disciplines, and disparate cultural spheres. Dr. Jason asks what it is about bass that has fascinated us for so long and made it such a busy site of biotechnological experimentation, driving developments in science, technology, the arts, and even religious culture. The guiding question is not so much what we make of bass, but what it makes of us. How does it undulate and unsettle? How does it incite? How does it generate the phenomenon of bodily thought? As one critic puts it, low-end theory, quote, provides us with an ontology of bass. I really like that. With its focus on sound structuring agency and the multi-sensory aspects of sonic experience, Dr. Jason's work stands to make a transformative contribution to the study of music and sound, while pushing scholarship on affect, materiality, and the senses into new, fertile territory. As a fellow basshead and former rave kid, I was especially excited to have the chance to speak with him about his book. Dr. Paul Jason received a BA in history from Lakehead University, and did his MA in Canadian Studies and PhD in Cultural Mediations at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Currently, he's an instructor in Music and Communication Studies at Carleton, and teaches courses in digital, visual, and audio culture, as well as digital media production. He has a professional background in web and multimedia development and graphic design. And he's also been a DJ, with recordings featured on radio and podcasts in several countries, and a sound designer, having collaborated with architects and cartographers on large-scale multimedia projects.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Music. My name's Carolyn Evans. I'm usually the host of the New Books in Secularism channel, but I recently ran across the book I have here today, Low-End Theory, Bass, Bodies, and the Materiality of Sonic Experience by Dr. Paul Jason. And I enjoyed it so much, I thought it was important to feature on the New Books Network. So here we are. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
I want to start by giving a little background for how I found your book, because it all started when we connected on academia.edu. And for anybody who's not familiar with it, this is a fantastic social network for academics and aspiring academics, by the way. So I downloaded one of your articles for a paper I was working on, and we ended up getting into a conversation about the topic. You very kindly gave me some excellent advice on additional sources, including low-end theory, and I ended up loving your book and using your concept of the materiality of bass as the theoretical framework for my paper.
That's great to hear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So shall we begin by perhaps you telling us how you came to write this book?
Sure. Well, I was finishing, I think I had just finished an MA in Canadian Studies. My focus was really the cultural studies end of that and popular music studies. I was looking at questions of identity, gender, sexuality, and race in a really bass-centric music culture jungle or drum and bass, and particularly in Toronto. And this, you know, came out of a long-standing interest in these kinds of things, following hip-hop and, you know, rave and jungle and all that before. And so this was summer of 2005. My wife and I ended up in London in this very small basement, which I actually describe in the book, being pummeled by bass. And this was a place called Plastic People, an event called Forward. And this was where early dubstep was being developed. A lot of low end, maybe a few hi-hats, little voice sample, and very little else. And we're in this small space and just being, you know, overwhelmed, knocked around by bass. It felt like it was coming out of my mouth. I had to open my mouth to let the pressure out. My ears were kind of being pushed out from the outside. My eyeballs were vibrating and so on. And as I say in the book, you know, I'm kind of being, you know, literally shaken out of certain academic habits, which were to, you know, largely avoid sensation, certainly the materiality of things in favor of, you know, questions of textuality, right? Like reading everything, the idea that you can read everything as if it were a book, whether it's a picture or a sound or a piece of music or a space, whatever. And so that it really came to me in that setting that this was this sort of this gaping, you know, empirical and theoretical area that people hadn't really dealt with.
Fantastic. Yeah, your book begins with a description of what it's like to be on a dance floor, maybe that dance floor, mm-hmm. Inundated by the almost overwhelming experience of the power of a massive sound system. And you say that when bass is vibrating at these low frequencies and at great volume, it has a material effect on our environment, such that we not only hear the sound, but perceive it as a physical sensation as well. You allude to your personal experience with this, and you include a lovely vignette about a girl dancing and responding to deep bass music that draws on aquatic language. Such swimming metaphors are in fact quite apropos, you explain, because high sound pressure levels like the ones created by bass pumping sound systems do in fact condense air, thicken it, and make it feel heavier. Heavy bass vibrations can also induce feelings of buoyancy, disrupt balance, as well as generally cause the entire body to vibrate along with it. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that for those sorry souls out there who've never had the experience of this firsthand, because mm-hmm. like you, I've been there in London with the massive bass.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people who have never felt that, it's hard to understand how thoroughly that impacts you physically.
Yeah. You know, there's a fantastic documentary about UK sound system culture called Musically Mad. And I think it's Mikey Dread being interviewed. And he says, you know, I can talk to you all night about sound systems, but you have to feel sound systems to know what they're about.
Right.
And I actually, you know, I think that's sort of the assumption a lot of the time in writing. So part of what I was aiming to do here was, as best I could, kind of try to put the reader in that sonic space. So, you know, we'll probably talk later about theories of affect and materiality, but I tried also to write in an affective way, a way that could, in some way, help you sort of perceive that kind of experience.
That's awesome. And as you were saying earlier, there's not a lot of people doing that right now in sound studies?
Yeah, not a lot. More now. Certainly when I started, it was kind of out in left field. There is a bit more going on, but I, you know, part of the idea with the book was to really kind of push people in that direction. And I do hope that it's taken as a challenge or invitation to pick up these questions that are less familiar, because I found in grad school, it's pretty easy to figure out what sort of norms are, what's kind of expected.
Right.
You learn to speak a certain language because it goes over well. And there are a lot of important things still to be dealt with that kind of language that emphasizes things like, you know, textuality and aspects of identity and so on. And they're not absent from what I'm doing, but I am challenging people to come at it from a different direction. I think there's a quote early on from Kodwo Eshin that, you know, suggests, like, at least let's try it. Let's just give it a shot for once and see what happens. So, you know, with this, I'm saying, what if we didn't start with this, you know, quote-unquote site, or this identifiable group, this sort of cultural specificity? What if we followed vibration around from place to place? So we don't look at like a very, say, the Toronto jungle scene. We don't go, okay, so what does bass mean in this place? Instead, we follow vibration around and we see how people are engaging with it in various places.
Okay. You've gestured a little bit at your theoretical approach. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that a little bit because it is fairly dense, but it's still accessible, I think. You explain how you see your work as fitting into a larger theoretical landscape of cultural studies. the ever-expanding range of study that is subject to linguistic and literature-derived analytical models, which you kind of mentioned there, as well as sound studies. You say that this is a landscape that tends to discredit immediate material experiences in favor of interpreting them as mediated and cerebral events. And in the context of music studies, this tends to mean that how music sounds and feels is often left out of the equation, even though this is the dimension privileged by participants. So you argue that more attention needs to be paid to the role of sensation in sonic culture. Mm-hmm. So have I got that right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, something that I noticed doing the research, I do a lot of sort of rereadings of other texts. There's a book by Lloyd Bradley called, Bass Culture, I forget. And it's about, it's a history of reggae. And, you know, bass gets discussed. There are some interesting anecdotes, but it doesn't really get beyond that. Bass is, has tended to be treated as kind of a mystery. You kind of gesture to its weirdness, but you kind of leave it at that.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to explore. And I forget exactly what you're pointing to.
Just how you're trying to thread the needle kind of between the science element and the cultural studies element.
That's the other thing, right? Because we're within the humanities, we've become very accustomed to critiquing science or the alleged objectivity or sort of infallibility of science.
Right.
But in my experience, that can kind of go overboard. I found even in sensory studies, there was this very explicit idea that you should kind of keep science at arm's length. And my thought was, well, how are you really going to deal with sensory experience without engaging that? We don't have to go full on into, neuroscience or something like that, but there must be some way to bridge the two. And this is where I found the theorist Brian Massumi quite helpful, because this is something that he's working with. You know, in his book Parables for the Virtual, he's dealing with this notion of affect, which is a bit of a difficult concept. We can see it as being related to sensation. It's often equated with emotion. In fact, it's often taken to be the same thing as emotion. But Massumi says, and he's following Deleuze, who's following Spinoza, that emotion is what he calls qualified affect. So affect tends to be something that kind of passes through us. It's kind of unnameable. It's kind of outside of language. When we give it a name, that's when it becomes emotion, some like nameable, recognizable thing.
Okay,
so that's where he's doing with, you know, affect in sort of a basic sense. With science, he's trying to look at how matters of affect and sensation work, you know, how the human body is engaging with things. He finds it necessary to draw on science, but in a critical way, but not an overly critical way. He says, I think really helpfully, he says we can poach from the sciences without being sort of beholden to their methods or their sort of standards. I think towards the end he says, science, philosophy, and art all have, you know, different claims to reality. They all speak to reality, the same reality, but in different ways. And none of those claims should really be prioritized over the other. They're simply different angles on it. So that was kind of a core idea for me running through this. So, you know, what I ended up doing was going to a lot of scientific literature on low-frequency sound and finding the sort of the things that kind of get left out, the marginal stuff that is treated as just marginal, rather than, you know, examples of, you know, anomalies that can be really, really rich territory if we follow them through, right? So I talk about, you know, the spectral sonically, but also among populations. There are those of us who will feel things differently from the majority, right? We might be outside of sort of the majority or the average, but there's something to be learned as well from those sort of anomalous experience, anomalous sort of sensitivities and so on.
Fantastic. I don't know if we have the time to quickly talk about Sun Ra. I want to get back to Sun Ra later,
sure,
as you do. But at the beginning, you talk about Sun Ra's use of the term myth science.
Yeah, so that served a couple of purposes for me. And the original title of this project was actually a bit punchier. It was called Base Myth Science of the Sonic Body. And, I think I agreed with the publisher. It'd probably be better to have something that was sort of more straightforward, but I do have a soft spot for that former title. So Sun Ra, the famous jazz musician whose career spanned, from the big band era into, the introduction of electronics into jazz. He's one of the first people, period, using synthesizers in music. He claimed he was from Saturn.
Uh-huh.
And
tried to dress like he was from Saturn.
Yeah, and there was this kind of notion around him, this kind of discourse around him, Sun Ra's crazy. John Swed, his biographer, and others have argued that this is really a misinterpretation of what was going on there. You know, when Sun Ra said that I'm not of this planet, this is someone who grew up in the deep south when African Americans were regularly being lynched. There was no justice for that. And he said, if this is humanity, I'm not human. If this is planet Earth, I'm not from here. I'm from a better place, right? So this is where his myth science comes from. And this could be extended in a lot of directions. And what I liked about it was that it could help me kind of do that poaching from the sciences, deal with the sort of mystifying dimensions of sonic experience. And I found that it worked really well with Kojo Eshin's concept of sonic fiction on one hand. So these are all the sort of, the idea is kind of musics that have a sonic fiction or science fictional dimension. So Sun Ra, obviously, but you find this in hip hop and elsewhere.
And there's a lot of it even in contemporary, drum and bass,
yep,
as well as dubstep.
And R&B recently as well.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The other concept that I found fit in with my sort of extended idea of myth science was nomad science from Deleuze and Guattari.
Okay.
French theorists who were very much about not taking a transcendent overall approach to things, the sort of thing that we inherit from Descartes and people who follow, but something much more inductive, so like exploratory. And this is really key to how I approach things, and I find it a lot in how people have explored and used and experimented with bass, right? Sort of like sort of following what happens if I do this, if I do this, if I do this, sort of prodding, tweaking, trying to like extract new, weird, stronger intensities from experience.
And that's a method that recalls earlier scientists, maybe.
Exactly.
Those kind of exploratory methods that you just follow where it goes.
Exactly. And that's the point that Deleuze and Guattari make, is that this was how science proceeded early on, when it was not really distinguishable from magic. The two were of the same
alchemists
family. Yeah. So you have, in their view, you've got theorematic science, which they call royal science with capital R and capital S, and then there's nomad science, which is really more that sort of radically empirical kind of approach, as you might say, following William James, who kind of figures into this too.
Wow. Okay. So chapter 2 focuses on what you term as inadvertent encounters with unheard vibrations. Those typically emerge from a natural or industrial source and exceed the usual definitions of sound. These infrasounds are understandably very mysterious seeming, and you write that they're frequently interpreted as hauntings because of the way they give one a sense of activity by an unseen agent. So can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, sure. So infrasound means, you know, literally below sound. It's below the audible range. So we're not talking so much volume as frequency. The human ear, if you buy, say, headphones, the headphone box will say, you know, it reproduces from 20 hertz to 20,000. That's usually considered the range of human hearing. Volume and everything plays a role in that. But below 20 hertz is infrasound. So hertz means cycles per second. That means how often that thing, you know, beats per second. When we start to head toward 20 hertz and then below it, things get weird. Things get weird if there's enough sound pressure involved. So this is another thing about, you know, how we hear. In the sort of 3-4 hertz range, so that's 3-4,000 cycles per second.
Okay.
That's where the most important parts of speech occur, like for intelligibility. And so in that range, we can hear, you know, that's where a whisper will happen, right? For the ear to perceive something at that bottom end of audibility at an equal volume to a whisper requires more or less about a million times the acoustic force, right? So when we're dealing with these low pressure, these low frequency sounds, if they're perceivable, they're very strong.
I see.
Yeah. It's a bit confusing until you go, okay, yeah, it's a matter of like, to even grasp it, there has to be a lot of force. Enough force to, say, blow out a candle.
Right.
To maybe, you know, move something that's very lightweight. Okay, so when we're heading into that range, other parts of the sensorium are picking things up, possibly well in advance of the ear, or at least out of sync with the ear. So you might have, say, one of the more prominent effects is, you know, stimulation of the inner ear, which you mentioned earlier. That's where motion and balance and stuff are felt.
Ah, so that's why it causes the disorientation.
Yeah. And so with this sort of haunting idea, you run into these anecdotes of people having felt presences and other anomalies that goosebumps can be brought on by frequencies in that range.
Okay.
And so these things that you tend to think like the goosebumps come after I'm scared, but it could be low frequency sound causing the goosebumps to pop up. And then you go, goosebumps, I must be scared. There must be something scary here, right?
Yeah.
So I was dealing with these stories where people were sensing presences and then it was like traced back to a source of infrasound. And the big name here is Vic Tandy, who was a British scientist who had a very alarming experience where he was in his laboratory, which people had said was haunted, and he found that his fencing blade, which he had put in a vise, you know, so this is a foil, right? It's just very thin, it's vibrating wildly. And the night before, he'd, you know, been looking around thinking there was just like a figure right next to him.
Huh.
It turned out to be a faulty ventilation fan sending infrasound into the space. And then he did exploration of another site, and acoustically it was prone to producing infrasonic resonances. So, you know, from there, I start to theorize, you know, how this works. And I looked at another phenomenon called the hum, which is, if you're in Britain, you may have heard about the Bristol hum. We apparently have one in Windsor. There's a famous one in Taos, New Mexico. These hums exist around the world, and they're experienced, you know, I was talking about spectrality, experienced only by a, you know, small spectrum of the human population, but they experience it so intensely that it can drive them a little bit crazy. Like,
wow.
It's this low frequency, usually kind of throbbing sound that most people can't hear. Most noise testing equipment is not calibrated
right, to
pick it up because it's not considered audible.
Yeah.
So if you have people experiencing something that's not audible and the equipment is not made to pick up things that aren't audible, you'll get a result that says there's nothing here. And this is kind of a recurring thing. There's actually, I think, a bit of a debate in Ottawa right now about public noise and big events and stuff that comes down to that. So I treat The Hum, you know, as another type of haunting, a very, like, they probably both have industrial and other origins. But the sort of really compelling quote that I got from a Hum researcher was that if you locate the source, it's not The Hum. Because almost by definition, The Hum is unfindable. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. So chapter 3, you begin looking at the phenomenon of base-making technologies that can be found around the world over and throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
You remark on the fact that we can find many examples of tremendous effort, skill, and resources being used for creating the effects of deep vibratory sound. And while there isn't any universal meaning that remains constant across cultures or anything like that, the fact of its common usage raises some really interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe could you start by telling us about what you term the monstrous sonorities of the medieval organ?
Sure. Okay, so I love the pipe organ, and the pipe organ is something that I came to via the sound system. And, you know, I mentioned early on that this started on dance floors, but it so quickly led everywhere else. And then, again, we're getting to this idea of, like, following it around and seeing where it leads. So, yeah, bass-making technologies in all these religious cultures. The organ goes back to, it's like about a 2,000-year-old machine. It's where the science of hydraulics is first sort of discovered and investigated, and later on pneumatics. So it's kind of like a scientific test bed as science is being invented. It comes from, I think it's not exactly clear. The person who invented it, his name is, it's Greek, Ctesibios, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, may have been Greek, but he may have come from around what is now Iraq. Anyway, so this thing has been developed for centuries. It kind of goes back to the East for a long time during the Dark Ages in Europe. It becomes this really mythical kind of thing. It starts to come back, and it's not a very refined technology. So when I talk about the monstrous sonorities of the medieval pipe organ, I'm talking about this machine that, based on reports, could have been quite huge. Like, there's one famous depiction of the organ at Winchester in England. And I always get this a little bit wrong, but audible at 5 miles, painful at 2, deadly at 1. Something
oh my gosh.
Like this. Whether or not that's totally true,
yeah.
you get the picture, right?
Yeah.
And you find these images from about that time, a little bit after, of these huge wind-driven things. So you imagine, like, bellows that you'd use for a fire. Huge bellows. People having to run upstairs, grab the handle, use their body weight to pull it down, and then run back up the stairs again. So this is where the force is coming from. We're talking about the Middle Ages, so, you know, woodworking and all these things are not terribly refined. So the wind chest is leaky, it's creaky, it vibrates a lot. Likewise, the pipes. But, you know, another really interesting idea that I came across it's actually a sort of an early sound studies piece, and it looks, I think, at the organ at Notre Dame Cathedral. It says, well, maybe this wasn't meant to be, maybe wasn't capable quite, but it also wasn't necessarily meant to be, you know, a perfect musical instrument. You find other quotes, like a priest from around that time talking about, you know, these roaring and jangling sounds. It just sort of reduced the body to, like, this quivering mass, basically. And so, you know, I run across a couple of people who say that, you know, maybe it was the force. It was the pain it induced. It was the fright that it could induce. Through, you know, low tones, sheer volume, distortion, all this. A fellow named Bruce Holsinger has written a book about the musical body in pain? I forget if that's the chapter or if it's the book. But, you know, he talks about how church music in the Middle Ages It was part of an overall program which, you know, frightened people into a sort of submissive belief. And he says, you know, at this time, you know, Gregorian chant, which we tend to think of, you know, remember it kind of comes back pretty big in the 90s, and it's new agey, it's really washy
and
reverberant. Exactly,
tape.
Yeah. probably, yeah, everyone of our generation had, you know, had something like that. So, but he says, at the time, Gregorian chant was inseparable from the image and the sting of Gregory's whip.
Oh.
Literally whipping people, literally hitting, hurting people, members of the choir, young students, and so on. So this is a violent period in religious culture, and it's expressed through this machine, it would seem.
Huh. Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. You wouldn't, you certainly wouldn't know that now, walking into a big cathedral mm-hmm. with a great big pipe organ at the back. You talk about the Baroque period, saying that at that time we find a much more refined bass technology, and you call it an explicit program of affect engineering that is coolly systematic in its effort to seduce the flesh into mm-hmm. belief. So there's a slightly different approach
there. Yeah, absolutely. So everything's gotten, like you say, more refined. the machine is simultaneously quieter in the sense that it's not producing all these distortions and vibrations and things, and more powerful because it can hold on to its air more effectively, can project it more effectively. and so at this time, too, you've got early Protestant efforts to turn this into something like a science. There's a program called the Doctrine of the Affections, which gets applied here. And the basic idea there is you know, observing how bodies respond to music in religious space, and, you know, tweaking that to get the most intense responses and the responses most conducive to producing belief or reinforcing belief. So this is not affect exactly as Masumi or Deleuze and Guattari would talk about it, but there is certainly a relationship there. And this idea of it being coolly systematic, you know, goes back to this idea of observing, kind of trying to dispassionately observe and make something like a science out of working on bodies.
Right, right. By the Gothic period, there's something called the Gothic assemblage, in which churches attempted to create in their congregation a feeling of heavenly ascent through the combination of light, space, and extracochlear vibration. So that sounds really amazingly ambitious and really technical for the time.
Ambitious beyond anything that we can really fathom right now, taking decades and even centuries to build these cathedrals, devoting, you know, amounts of resources that we can't even really imagine these days, and to produce something that is considered not just a monument to God, but really a vector that through which, you know, we can be transmitted heavenward and it can be transmitted down to us. And I talk about it in terms of a Gothic assemblage because I'm looking now even more so at like a total synesthetic project, I call it, where all of the senses are being worked on very intensely. I should also note, like, we've gone Baroque and now Gothic, and we tend to think of those historically reversed. But if these churches are taking so long to be built, then they're some of them being completed after the Baroque period or during the Baroque period. So it gets blurred that
okay.
way. The point being that you've got these churches that are kind of science fictional almost in their hugeness, their technological sophistication and so on, and you've got this very powerful machine. There's this idea that the size of the church actually forces the organ to get bigger and more powerful. So it's doing its thing, but you've also got these efforts to sort of unsteady people with weird mixtures of light, for example. Stained glass, huge windows are suddenly, not suddenly, but they're now possible. And the idea with Gothic was to make this kind of like skeletal structure, by the standards of the time, kind of impossible looking structure. Like, how is this thin, light looking thing that seems to be sort of flying in these different directions? How is it even standing? How is it possible? And so there's this sort of like vertiginous pull built into the architecture, like kind of pulling you up. There's the organ working on your vestibular system to kind of like make you feel floaty and stuff. You've got these weird mixtures of light probably coming in from solid primary colored windows at the time, so blue, yellow, red, making like different mixtures of color in the space. You've got the smells and everything, the incense and so on. So the idea with the Gothic assemblage and the total synesthetic project is that sort of everything is being worked on to sort of unsteady people, give them a sense of sort of something tending toward that upward flight that is being sort of proposed there. And you have to remember, too, that there was no effort to translate the Bible into local languages at the time, right? So it's all happening through, you know, what you feel, what you see, hear, and otherwise feel. And my focus is very much on what you otherwise feel through viscera, vestibular, fear, like all these things working together.
Wow, that paints an incredible picture. And
ecstasy,
that
too, I should say, in that situation. Not just fear, because you got fear
right.
more in the earlier period, but really something that's, sort of heavenly.
My goodness. I had no idea that is what was going on when you walk into a cathedral now. Next, you focus on some different secular examples of the exploration of various facets of sound, starting with what is called the cymatic arts. So can you perhaps explain for our listeners what cymatic means and give us some examples?
Sure. And I've just now drawn a blank on the name of the person who theorized cymatics. I don't know if you've noted it there.
I've got the German sound artist Thomas Kohner, but he's an artist,
yep,
so probably not the theorist.
Yeah, I talk about him. That's actually one of the parts that I enjoyed writing the most. Let's just see if I can get the name really fast. Hans Jenny. So Hans Jenny theorizes cymatics, and his idea is, you know, to find ways of visualizing sound. Well, not just visualizing sound. This is the thing that he's usually associated with. If you look up cymatics online, you'll tend to find pictures or videos of like a water cornstarch mixer in a speaker.
Right.
And it's jumping around in all these ways. And that's really fascinating because you're seeing something that sound does that you otherwise wouldn't be able to perceive. There's no way to quite grasp all that's going on. And, you know, my thought is, you know, one of the first impressions we would have is sort of this like bodily felt question, like sort of, oh, me too, right? If that's how that works, what's going on inside me? But he talks about cymatics in a much larger sense. Oceans, you know, wave patterns and so on, but also, you know, mountain formation. You can view that as just a much, much, much slower paced version of the same thing. So he's interested in, you know, that sort of the sort of cyclic patterns that structure a lot of the world. And, you know, understandably, it's caught the attention of people interested in sound.
Great. So I wanted to read a short quote from your book that I think will help our listeners grasp the intended effect of a cymatic work by German sound artist Thomas Kohner, who explores the vibrations of metal and the movements of icebergs, among other things. So you write that with regard to the latter, the icebergs, the goal is for the listener to experience, quote, becoming mineral an attempt to enter the sound world of the fossil and the ice mummy at no distance. Its success is not based on getting it right or exact. By the same token, any similarity to iceberg recordings is ultimately inconsequential. What matters is whether it works well enough to tilt bodily imagination towards processes and periodicities that are alien to it. As a cymatic investigation, it attempts to inhabit vibration, to grasp what it would be to sense it from within, rather than merely observing it at a remove.
Right. Yeah. So I'll just I'll clarify. So I'm talking about some iceberg recordings that were published online, and a very strong similarity to these Thomas Conner recordings. Actually, if you slow down those iceberg recordings, they're sped up so that we can hear them because the frequencies involved were so low that they're inaudible. So they're sort of arbitrarily pitched elsewhere. Conner makes something that sounds kind of similar, but he's done it all with recordings of gongs. So there's no field recording involved here, and I kind of compare what he's done to actual field recordings. And he records these gongs not with a microphone in a studio like we're using right now, but with contact microphones. They're suctioned on to the gong, and they get the internal acoustics of it when it's struck. So this is the basis of his material, but he's working with sort of a sonic fiction, like I mentioned earlier. And Kojo Eshin talks about sonic fictions, particularly in terms of instrumental music, where there are no words, there's nothing really to guide you apart from, you know, images, sleeve notes, and things like that. Conner's images and sleeve notes all revolve around early explorers of the Arctic and a little bit Antarctica as well, getting lost, freezing, and basically getting absorbed into the ground. So this is sort of where the ice mummy comes in. What I'm trying to deal with here is how an artist uses sound to sort of put the listener in a situation that's otherwise not perceivable. And I'm using this idea from Deleuze and Guattari and others of inhuman becomings. How do we how do we sort of perceive beyond our human sensorium? And that's kind of the core idea here.
Cool. Another really fascinating and unusual example of the vibratory arts is something called incipient dance.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and about the work of Mark Bain, a seismic artist who builds portable earthquake machines, which mm-hmm. sounds pretty amazing. So what is that about?
Yeah. So Mark Bain, like you said, he's a sound artist. He describes his work in seismic terms. He's done things like taken seismic recordings of the Twin Towers falling during 9/11 and making them audible, sonifying it. Describes that as the screamingness of the earth when they crumble to the ground. The one that I focus on primarily is an installation that he did in a disused missile silo. And he looked at this missile silo, which has a floating floor. I don't know exactly how that works, but I think it's on... Is it on sand? I don't remember what it's on. But he looks at it and says, this is not unlike a speaker.
Hmm.
And in his previous work, he has used mechanical oscillators, so something that creates a vibration at a low frequency, to resonate large structures. So he finds the resonant frequency. If you think... You know, the good way to think about what resonance can do is, you know, the image of the opera singer and the wine glass shattering.
Right.
They're hitting that pitch at which that body doesn't just vibrate, but amplifies itself to the point of its own destruction. So he's done similar things short of destruction to bridges and other things. In the live room, this one in the missile silo, he resonates this this whole space. And he actually covers the floor with sand, so you get these like cymatic arrangements of sand that show us the frequencies passing through. And what he does is he gets people to just enter and explore. And what he finds when he's changing the frequencies, when he's sending different frequencies through this massive speaker, through these bodies collected on it, is that he can kind of make them respond in different ways. So we have something, you know, a little bit like that idea of working on the body in the Baroque period, trying to induce certain things. He found that people sort of, they would move kind of together, like a collectivity kind of forms. And sound, they're not like going, oh, sound, I'm going to dance to it. They're really being danced by sound. They're being brought into movement by sound. So incipience, you know, refers to, you know, the becoming of something. Something's on its way to another condition. And so I'm looking at this idea of incipient dance in terms of the way that sound can be used to bring us into movement, collectivity, collectively, rather than us just sort of interpreting sound, again, as text, right? Like, how will I move to the sound based on my background, what it represents, you know, how we're all operating in a visual economy, all these things that popular music studies and related fields tend to go back to. So I'm really looking at, and this, you know, brings us back to the dance floor eventually. How does an artist of whatever kind, an organist, you know, a sound artist in an installation, a DJ, how have they used low frequencies to induce collective motion?
Yeah, so that brings us back to the dance floor, right, which is where the book begins. And that is with the use of deep bass technology in the service of music, interacting with the sonic body through the language of dance. So Jamaican sound system culture is of great importance here, of course, as well as certain popular musics, or musics made popular in clubs and on dance floors since the 1970s, give or take. In these contexts, bass fills much more than the supporting role that it has in Western musics like pop, country, or rock, for example. So can we start with Jamaica? Can you give us a brief history of the Jamaican sound system culture?
Sure. Well, the importance of the sound system in Jamaica, maybe to simplify, but it boils down to the fact that poorer black people, didn't really have the resources or the venues to play live music with bands. So sound systems tended to fill that space. They also, the music that really sort of the music of the people rather than the ruling class didn't really feature on the radio. So to have, you know, a collective music culture, people developed these sound systems, which started in, I think, largely shop windows and so on, but then become their own entities and then become these sort of cultural centers. Someone like Norman Stolzoff has actually linked this back to, he says, you know, the dance hall goes back to early slave days and those musical congregations. He sees it as an extension. But, of course, you know, post-war, this gets heavily technologized, and really a lot of contemporary dance music culture, and I mean across the board, owes its way of operating to Jamaica, to the powerful sound system, and to the advent of the DJ as performer, and then also from that, the advent of remixing and all this. But bass has always been, you know, very central there. And the competition between sound systems really helped sort of intensify that.
You tell us, or you use the term bass science, and you allude to the expression drop in science.
Mm-hmm,
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. If you follow hip-hop and also drum and bass and other things, this word science keeps recurring. And the idea that I'm really working with here is that it tends to be about some element of mystification. Rhythm science is a term that's been applied, say, to the very fractured, complex, sort of almost M.C. Escher-like rhythms that you'd find in 90s jungle. Vocal science was a term applied to chopped-up vocals, where an original bit of speech is cut up in ways that turn, gasps and other sounds into rhythmic components, textural components, and so on.
Almost percussion sometimes.
Yeah, percussive, certainly confusing in terms of what's being said. Your imagination is drawn in to try to figure out what is actually being said. Bass science is another term that you'll come across, and I've used it here to describe, this thing that I've been tracing all the way through from, the Middle Ages and earlier, where people are sort of trying to mystify the body with unusual perceptions of sound.
Okay, fantastic. And that kind of goes to what I was going to ask you about next, and that goes back to the poet and jazz musician Sun Ra. Let's talk about how he used his music intentionally to defamiliarize the world in his effort to conjure a new reality.
Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, I never saw Sun Ra live, but it was a very immersive experience, certainly one that was meant to unsteady audiences and draw them into his world, out of theirs and into his world.
He can be found on YouTube for listener who's interested. There's some snippets on YouTube that'll give you a sense.
Yeah, so sonically, visually, with costumes and other things. And, being, like I said, one of the early users of synthesizers and trying to produce sound worlds that had not been experienced before. There are many directions with Sun Ra, many facets of this myth science and this sort of otherworldliness.
Okay. So then we turn to the musics on the bassy end of the EDM spectrum, if we can forgive the use of the term. So we're talking here about stuff like UK jungle, garage, drum and bass, and breakbeat. Is there more that you can tell us about those in particular and their relation to bass science?
Yeah, I mean, bass has, like I say, been foundational. You get it certainly from Jamaica, but it was also important in disco. I tend to look at the 1970s with, dub and the sound system, and then disco, and then following them, hip-hop, and then, synth-pop via Kraftwerk and so on, as sort of foundational to everything that we have now. And certainly within that sort of dub to disco spectrum, bass is really prominent. I think I've got an anecdote in there about, I think it was the Paradise Garage. So we're at the end of disco, the beginning of House and Garage, which is really the beginning of our current moment. And they're experimenting with, speaker placement and stuff. And they discover that if you put an open-backed bass speaker in a corner, it actually uses the entire room as its cabinet, the thing that it derives sonic force from. So you literally have people putting the dance floor inside a speaker. When you get to, hip-hop, of course, has always had an interest in bass. And when you've got, when you get that electro element emerging early on, that 808 bass drum, I mean, we look at music now like trap. It goes back to, in a sense, Planet Rock and the 808, Roland 808 drum machine. Rave gives way to jungle. Jungle's drawing on the dance hall. You've got that low end. You've got these very fast rhythms with bass lines typically running at halftime. So you've got this fractured rhythm kind of pulling the body in all these directions, and this deep bass like kind of pulling it downward or sort of propelling it. We get to dubstep. I already mentioned, you know, around that early period, 2003, 2004, 2005, there's not a lot of mid-range. It's like all sub and just enough high end in the rhythm to give it kind of a slinky kind of rhythm, very different from the sort of Skrillex type of thing that we associate the word dubstep with now. This was really a division of frequencies between just, like I say, this kind of slinky UK garage rhythm and then sub, just working on the body.
And some of it removes the drum entirely,
yep,
and creates the rhythm just with the deep bass. So you have,
yep,
tracks that really focus on developing just that deep bass alone,
yeah,
which I love.
Yeah, no, it's a, and it's a, like I say, it's a phenomenal, and like, as you know, a phenomenal experience to hear that just emphasized on its own. When I was in that space and forward, you know, you've got that enveloping bass, and then these, like, there are sometimes these samples of just breath. So you're struggling to figure out if you're breathing or not, and this system is like projecting the sound of strained breath at you as well. It's really,
my gosh,
really disorienting.
Yeah. Many people find that the never-ending subgenres of electronic music are a bit overwhelming or just annoyingly impossible to follow. This is, of course, a reflection of how rapidly the music evolves or how much it lends itself to permutation and evolution. You use a metaphor of an operating system that you call a rhythm machine,
sure,
to kind of explain this process,
sure,
if I got you correctly there. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that metaphor.
Sure. So I've mentioned Kodwo Eshin a couple of times already. This comes from his book, More Brilliant Than the Sun, Adventures in Sonic Fiction, where he's, because I've talked about Sonic Fiction already, he talks about these various aspects of the science as well. The thing I would say about the rhythm machine is, it's actually not a metaphor. It's via him, I'm trying to really look at this as a literal operating system.
Okay.
A way of operating on a couple of levels. When we talk about rhythm machines, you can use that in place of style or genre or something. You could look at house as kind of like a meta machine and all these different subgenres as rhythm machines within it. And those individual rhythm machines, they will have like very narrowly defined often parameters in terms of the tempo, so the beats per minute. Sometimes, like that period of dubstep we're talking about, you'd find a range of only about 3 beats per minute, 137 to 140, maybe.
Okay.
Footwork, faster kind of thing, a lot of 808 kick drums. It's so fast, it's so complicated, there's barely like a perceivable continuity,
right,
sometimes, that I think a lot of those producers produced at exactly the same tempo so that it works in the DJ mix. Because, you know, a record, or maybe not a record anymore, but a track made to be used in one of those mixes, it's not really a song, it's a track. It's open-ended. It's each, the beginning and the end are meant to be woven with other stuff. So in that sense, you can imagine like an overall operating system. You can imagine that the tracks themselves as software, and they conform to the needs of an operating system so that in the DJ mix they work. But I'm also looking at those, kind of trying to extend further from Eshin into how those rhythm machines and those kind of operating systems, they are actually ways of operating on bodies. They're ways of orchestrating or at least potentializing bodies in certain ways. So I use the term capacitance, and I'm thinking actually of, you know, a capacitor in electronics. A capacitor takes in electricity, it holds onto it, and it releases it at whatever rate it's being told to. And I'm looking at how these rhythm machines do similar types of stuff. You know, they literally inject energy into a space, into a collectivity, into a group, and they will have their own ways, these different styles or rhythm machines, they have their own ways of trying to bring bodies into motion, of directing that energy. So it does sound a bit abstract, but I'm trying to make... Actually, I like something that Masumi says. He says that, you know, the problem is not really about theory getting into abstract. He says real life is really, really complex. We need to try to find language that's appropriate to it. And that's actually a key idea through the whole book. Right. I don't think we've had adequate language for this type of stuff. So it's an experiment in developing a language and certainly inviting people to experiment with that more. Don't worry about inventing terms and concepts and stuff. Do it because we need it. And the music suggests it. The music comes with its own concepts. So in a sense, we kind of have to decode them as well.
Great. Okay. So your conclusion is entitled, Where Next? As you point out, deep bassy sounds permeate our culture more than ever now. Pop music commonly incorporates dubstep elements now, for example. Mm-hmm. But we also see a deeper range in non-music-based contexts like home theaters and in other places. So one might imagine that this suggests that interest in the effects of bass and sub-bass will continue to grow. In your conclusion, you express the hope that your research may suggest a way for audiology and the study of sonic culture to benefit from communicating with each other rather than remaining on either side of the science-humanities divide, as they may perceive themselves presently. So your conclusion asks, what next? Can you speak to that a bit?
I'm not sure I know right now.
Fair enough.
Yeah, there are a lot of ideas in here, and I'm hoping that they can be picked up on in various ways. But I do hope that, and I think this has begun to happen more since I started writing this, I think there is now more interest in the materiality of things, in dealing with the sensory aspects of music and all these different dimensions. So I think the what next is kind of like an invitation to just kind of go on from here and see what else we can do with
follow
it.
Follow the nomad science.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Excellent.
And, you know, I end with a permutation of that famous idea from Spinoza. You know, he says, what can a body do? I'm saying, what more can a sonic body do?
Okay.
I don't think we'll ever be quite sure what it can do, but we can keep exploring it to see what's there. And it can keep sort of teaching us as well.
Fantastic. Well, Paul, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, can you tell us what you're currently working on?
Sure. I've got a few things in the works. This fall, so fall 2017, I'm looking at starting a new web project, possibly podcast, called A People of Oscillators, .com, that will look quite a bit at synthesis, especially modular synthesis, you know, these ones that look like big telephone switchboards. I've become really fascinated with that. I was recently in Calgary looking at some of the collection at the National Music Center, including a huge custom-built device called Tonto, which was started in 1968. It's a room-sized modular synthesizer. I got to spend a lot of time, have sort of a private tour with that. So I think we'll be kicking off with that. I've got a number of other things planned for that. So that's a peopleofoscillators.com. I have a couple of other things on the go. One is a potential project on sort of stranger aspects of pop music. And there's a concept that has sort of haunted me from this book, this idea of the man-made unknown. I'm really interested in ways that humanly, you know, built technologies start to exceed our understanding of them. They start to kind of take on their own life. So that's sort of an ongoing thing. We'll see what happens with it. But these are some of the areas that I'm probing at the moment.
That's great. I look forward to following that. So I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. And hopefully you can come back with further books in the future.
That'd be great.
So thanks very much and goodbye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
I want to thank you for listening to the podcast today. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Dr. Paul Jason about his book, Low End Theory, Base, Bodies, and the Materiality of Sonic Experience. If you're interested in purchasing the book, I'm happy to tell you it's going to be available in softcover next month. You can find it on the publisher's website at bloomsbury.com and on Amazon as well. You can also find out more about Paul at one of his websites, www.riddim.ca, that's RIDDIM.ca, deeptime.net/blog, or at his upcoming site, apeopleofoscillators.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and follow the New Books Network on Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. You can also find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynland, that's at CarrieLynnLand, where I generally post about science fiction and science and tech news. Did you find this book interesting? Let me know. I'd love to hear what you think. Goodbye until my next conversation about New Books in Secularism.